New York Times reporter Chris Hedges was a war correspondent for 15 years. He covered wars in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Colombia, the West Bank and Gaza, Yemen, the Persian Gulf, Bosnia and Kosovo. Now he's written a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Hedges told Ann Strangchamps that wars get a lot of people juiced up, and that's a real problem.
War, as it's presented to us, is, of course, completely a myth, and it is bolstered by these abstract phrases, patriotism, glory, honor, all this kind of stuff, which, once one gets into combat, are rendered not only hollow, but probably obscene. You see within this mythic presentation of war, and you know, this is presented not only by the entertainment industry, but by the state and by the press as well. We give war a coherent narrative it doesn't have. Frankly, the myth, it boosts ratings. Look at CNN. It sells newspapers. William Randolph Hearst built his newspaper empire on a mythic war and a war that he helped fabricate.
Is it a kind of knee-jerk construction in which everybody participates without really being aware of what they're doing, or is it quite deliberate?
I don't think it is deliberate. I think there is a feeling among most of the press that they're part of the war effort and that they have to help bolster morale. But there is a kind of need and a hunger. In the Persian Gulf War, the press fell all over themselves to turn General Schwarzkopf into a hero. And it doesn't really matter whether it was General Schwarzkopf or someone else. We needed that notion of the leader is hero.
During the Persian Gulf War, the U.S. military required all the reporters to sign a pledge that they'd stay with the reporting pool, and you signed it, but then you went out on your own. Why did you do that?
Because I don't work for the U.S. military, and they can't tell me what to do. Well, that's another part of the problem, in that not only does most of the press feel that they're part of the war effort, but I think they often quite willingly function as a propaganda wing of the military. I mean, one of the pernicious aspects of the pool system was not only the very heavy control, the fact that the military decided where reporters can go and what they could see and what they would report on, but that it was actually administered by the press, by reporters such as Carl Ann Robbins from the Wall Street Journal and others. And if it had not been administered by them, by my colleagues, it wouldn't have worked. There was a real collusion between the press and the military, as there is always in wartime.
Is that part of why, although wars get covered almost ad nauseum once they begin, especially on cable television shows, at the same time, there's a kind of unreality? I mean, there's constant war coverage, but there's almost no coverage of actual battlefields.
No, because the very essence of war, which is death, is hidden from public view, just as it was in the Persian Gulf War. We saw video clips of Sidewinder missiles and cruise missiles hitting buildings, this kind of stuff. And people had a very false perception of what the war was and what war is. I was on the border with the Marine Corps and went into Kuwait with the Marines. And night after night, there were waves of Vietnam War era B-52 bombers dropping huge iron fragmentation bombs all over southern Iraq. Yet I think most Americans had this perception of precision-guided weapons, you know, hitting exact targets. And these weapons constituted a minuscule percentage. I can't remember, 2 or 4% of all the ordnance dropped on Iraq. And then, of course, we didn't see any dead. We didn't see the tens of thousands of Iraqi dead. They were nameless, faceless phantoms. And we didn't see our own dead. There was, you know, a prohibition imposed on the press covering bodies coming back to Dover. And I think, as you point out, we had no sense of war at all. War had become a spectator sport.
So this notion of a surgical strike or the new technology of war that will make war almost unbloody is another myth? Wars today are as bloody as they've ever been?
Even worse, because you have, you know, modern industrial warfare. You know, I mean, look at the shock and awe. I mean, I hate the term. It's so Orwellian, but you know, shock and awe. In the first 48 hours, we dropped 3,000 precision-guided missiles on Baghdad and the surroundings. I mean, we are talking about many, many, many civilian dead and the indiscriminate murder of civilians. The question is whether it'll be covered. The Pentagon is doing a pretty good job of trying to scare most journalists out of Baghdad, and I hear from colleagues at the BBC that they have been told that if they uplink from Baghdad to their satellites, they will be considered a target.
You write about what's addictive about the nature and the culture of war. And I'm curious, I understand that there's the myth of war that can carry countries and even individual soldiers into battle. But what happens when the combat finally becomes real? Why do soldiers who've lived through any kind of combat stay? Is it just peer pressure?
Well, you know, once you fall into combat, soldiers fight for each other. They don't fight for the flag and all that kind of stuff. You also, there's a huge disconnect once you sort of fall into the subculture that is war. There's a huge disconnect between the experience that you're living and the rest of, let's call it peacetime society or home, the home front. I mean, I felt this when I left Sarajevo. I'd be in a hotel room in Paris, sort of pacing up and down the halls, dying to get back, feeling that I had, you know, abandoned friends of mine that were there. But I think on a deeper level, it just became hard to function without that adrenaline rush, without that sense of purpose. You become alienated from the world not at war, and that's part of war's sickness. You know, you see after a war the attempts by veterans to recreate the kind of comradeship that they feel in war. This, of course, can never be recreated, but it's what they seek. I mean, most soldiers that have been through combat, I mean, they hate war in the way that only a soldier can, but what they miss is that sense of belonging. And this always happens when you face death not as an individual, but as a group, and death becomes much easier to bear. There is a kind of ecstatic bliss in this, and that is one of war's attractions.
Boy, those are strong words. Ecstatic bliss?
Well, the enterprise of war can be perversely thrilling. And you see it when units go into towns and are given the license to destroy everything, including other human beings. It's as if, I mean, they sputter gibberish, their eyes are glazed over. There is a divine-like power that you have at that moment, and it's one of the most frightening things you learn about war, and that is how that lies beneath the surface of all of us, and that capacity for atrocity or capacity for evil that is within all of us.
So it's more than just that they become numb to the fact of death and numb to the atrocities. It's that they court them.
Yes, I mean, they court them. I mean, war is about necrophilia. I mean, what finally happens is that, I mean, war always begins by calling for the annihilation of the other, but when pursued unchecked, when embraced, it's always about self-annihilation. I think war is the most powerful narcotic invented by humankind.
One of the most devastating sections of your book is a description of a recent trip you made to the Gaza Strip when you watched Israeli soldiers deliberately kill a group of young Palestinian boys. I wondered if you'd tell us about that.
What's happening in Gaza and the West Bank is very much an experience that we as Americans shared in Vietnam. You have an elusive enemy who you can't find. You have roadside bombs going off, killing comrades, suicide bombers, you know, blowing themselves up in shopping malls. And you have what people like Robert J. Lifton called atrocity-producing situations, where because you can't find the enemy, because you live in an environment or you're surrounded by a sea of people who are hostile, you make that kind of transference where everything, you know, elderly people, children, it doesn't matter, everyone is the enemy, so that you can be gunning down a 10-year-old kid and sort of psychologically believe that it's a legitimate kind of revenge and that somehow they are guilty, they're culpable. And that is what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, which I think this scene portrays.
So what happened?
I was in the Khan Yunis refugee camp, and that camp is surrounded in horseshoe shape by Jewish settlements with a big electric fence. This camp is one of the most densely populated, Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on the planet, and this camp is just packed. It's wall-to-wall people, 10 people sleeping on the floor of a room. The children have no place to play, so they play out in the dunes at the base of the electric fence. And the first day I was there, I speak Arabic, I heard the loudspeakers on the Israeli armored jeep, mind you, from the other side of the fence, calling to the kids, Ta'al, ta'al, come, in Arabic. then these were kids, you know, they weighed 70, 80 pounds, started throwing rocks. They couldn't even reach the vehicle. And they were cursing at them in Arabic and insulting them in Arabic. This was from the Israeli Jeep. And then they opened fire. And they did this every single day I was there. And these were not rubber bullets. These were live rounds from M16 rifles, which are designed to go in you about the size of a dime and come out of you the size of an orange. They spin end over end. And I went to the hospital afterwards to visit these kids, and I went to the funerals of the kids who were killed. And it was enticement. I mean, I've seen children killed in Sarajevo and other places, but I'd never seen kids enticed like mice into a trap and killed for sport.
How did you keep yourself from slipping over the edge in all of this? I mean, reading your book, there are scenes that are really difficult to read. You know, at a nighttime in Bosnia and a truckload of bodies and you having to go through them to see whether any were mutilated or not. I mean, there's scene after scene like this. How did you stay sane?
Well, you don't. I mean, you have moments when you don't. And I describe some of those in the book, at a moment in an airport in Costa Rica where I leapt over the counter and beat up an airline clerk. I mean, in El Salvador, I just accepted the conclusion that I would die there. I read a lot. It sounds sort of hokey, but that was really important. And I read a lot of great stuff, Conrad, Shakespeare, Homer. And when you read great literature, they often grapple with these issues, the capacity for evil, Primo Levi, and those were voices that kept me balanced. I think the other difference between myself and, let's say, a Vietnam veteran, and Vietnam vets are usually the people I can sort of relate to emotionally the best, is that I did have a feeling of purpose. I believe that what was happening in Sarajevo was a crime, and it was wrong, and that the risks that I took were worth taking to explain to the world that this was criminal, that this was genocide, and that we should stop it. But all that said, I have post-traumatic stress disorder, I have nightmares, I can fall into depression. For a while I was drinking too heavily until I just sort of stopped drinking completely. I wouldn't even have a glass of wine. These are huge psychological scars that I will bear with me for the rest of my life.
You said when you were covering El Salvador, you accepted at a certain point that you were just going to die. And yet you kept going back. And you also write about war reporters and war photographers you've known who did keep going back, knowing that they were going to die. And in fact, they did die. They were killed. What is that?
It is the inability to exist outside of war, to find meaning and contentment in life outside of war. People who are attracted to these situations, it's not just that they're attracted to them, but it's also that they're running away from things. You know, I think in that sense, it is analogous to a drug addict where you need the high. You need that combat high, and you will take any risk to get it. Soldiers feel this, and if you can't shake free from that, eventually it's going to kill you. And I ended up in Gaza at the beginning of this intifada and got caught in a very bad ambush in the Netzarim Junction, and a kid was about 10 feet away from me, was shot through the chest and killed. And I realized that I had to stop. All that said, it was extremely difficult.
Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. His book is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He talked with Anne Strainchamps.